Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident. This is episode 137 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And this podcast is going to be kind of like a unique one. Again, I've gotten this request a couple of times, but again, it's just time constraints that just, again, make this really difficult to do. But this podcast, I would hope, is one, especially because I've been getting, in fact, like more recently, like a lot of requests. Thankfully, the website has been a little more popular. And, you know, this is like step 2CK month for people that want to try to, you know, get in those scores for the applications. So this podcast, I'm going to call it the Next Best Step in Management podcast. And I am going to try to go through a very large number of pathologies and talk about what your next best step in management should be for those pathologies. I think that should help you quite tremendously on exams. And again, this is obviously not something that, again, one can cover in one podcast, but I will try to be as, you know, as comprehensive as possible. I mean, again, within limits of reason, right? I would not want to make this monster podcast that, I mean, it would be great to make, but again, there are time limits, and I also have, unfortunately, other commitments. Okay, so what if they give you, so we'll just jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a 55-year-old guy, and this guy, he comes to the doctor's office and says that yesterday he lost vision in one eye, kind of felt like a curtain was coming down, and but that within 5 minutes his symptoms resolved. What is your next step in management? Your next step actually in diagnosis will be a carotid ultrasound, right? I know you may want to be saying, oh, Divine, it's a stroke, so let me do a non-con CT. Don't do that. If a person has like neurologic symptoms that they completely recover from, right, essentially like a TIA, your next step in diagnosis on an MBME exam is to perform a carotid ultrasound. And then after that, your next step in management will be to treat those people with an antiplatelet agent. Very high yield to know this, with an antiplatelet agent. So you want to treat them with drugs like aspirin, or you want to treat them with drugs like dipyridamole, or drugs like clopidogrel. Okay? You may say, Divine, why can I not use things like heparin and warfarin? You can. But those things are really correct for TIAs on MBME exams. The only time that they will be correct is if they tell you expressly in the question that the patient has a history of AFib or has like some kind of like prosthetic valve. Then under those circumstances, if they have TIA symptoms, the smart play will be to give them an anticoagulant like heparin or warfarin. I mean, obviously it will likely be warfarin, but you just sort of bridge them with a heparin. Now, what if they give you a question about a 55-year-old guy, okay, and this guy comes in complaining of the worst headache of his life, right? The worst headache of his life, and they tell you that this person, you know, this worst headache started like 30 minutes ago, and then they try to trick you in the question by saying that this person has nuchal rigidity, and they may even give you like a mild fever, let's say like 100.9. What's your diagnosis here? I would hope you're saying this is a subarachnoid hemorrhage. So what is your next best step in diagnosis, right? For this person, obviously, you want to proceed with getting a non-conscious head CT, right? But if that is equivocal or you don't get the results, you like you still strongly suspect the subarachnoid and the non-con head CT is negative, right? The next thing you proceed to is to get a lumbar puncture because you're looking for xanthochromia, right? And then your next best step in management for a subarachnoid hemorrhage, right, will be to control blood pressure. So you want to keep those people's blood pressures low, right? So you want to give them things like labetalol or nitroprusside. Usually labetalol is the safe bet on MBMEs, right? You want to give them like labetalol to lower their blood pressures. And then you also want to give them nimodipine, right? So that they don't get an ischemic stroke on top of the hemorrhagic stroke they just had. Now, what if you get a question about a 55-year-old female, comes in, says that she's been having like headache, kind of like localized to like one side of her head, and she tells you that over the last that like 2 weeks ago she had trouble like chewing with her jaw, right? So obviously this is jaw claudication, and this person has like a concomitant temporal arthritis. your next step in management for these patients is to proceed to giving high dose corticosteroids, so like a high dose glucocorticoid. And then after that, you can then consider doing a temporal artery biopsy, okay, to sort of help with to figure out exactly what's going on. And since we're talking about a temporal arteritis, I will just go ahead and dovetail into polymyalgia rheumatica, right? Remember, that presents as like proximal shoulder pain, and the ESR will be elevated in those patients. And really, your next step in management is low dose, not high dose. High dose is for temporal arteritis. Low dose corticosteroids for polymyalgia rheumatica. So you give them low dose corticosteroids. And then in addition to that, you also do a temporal artery biopsy. So you may say, Divine, but this person is not complaining of temporal arteritic symptoms. I promise you, it's high yield to know this. If a patient has polymyalgia rheumatica, you need to perform a temporal artery biopsy, because they may not be having symptoms, but they may actually have like inflammation of their temporal arteries going on at the same time as their polymyalgia rheumatica. And then what if they give you a question about a 60-year-old guy comes in over the past 24 hours, he's been altered, he's been, you know, kind of like confused, he has a temperature of like 102, and he has no core rigidity on exam, right? So obviously this is meningitis, right? So your next step in management, right, will be to, your next step in management sort of depends on two pathways, right? So the first one will be, do they have signs of elevated intracranial pressures, right? So if, for example, the patient has like papular edema on exam, or they have any signs of elevated intracranial pressure, then your next step will actually be to proceed to antibiotic therapy. And I'll talk about what antibiotic therapy means in a second. But if you don't see that as an answer, if they don't have any signs of elevated intracranial pressure on exams, then your next step in diagnosis actually for these people is to pursue obtaining a lumbar puncture. And then right after that, you empirically give them antibiotics. And the empiric antibiotics you want to give to an old person, right, a person more than the age of 50, that's coming in with essentially meningitis, right, you want to give them a combination of ceftriaxone, vancomycin, and ampicillin. So ceftriaxone, vancomycin, and ampicillin. I'll repeat that again. Ceftriaxone, vancomycin, and ampicillin. You're giving ceftriaxone to cover like strep pneumo as the cause of meningitis, or even Neisseria meningitis. You're given the vancomycin to cover inadvertent MRSA meningitis, and then you're given the ampicillin to cover listeria. Remember, whenever you see a person that has meningitis and they're young, like super young, like a neonate kind of deal, or they're old, if the person is more than 50 years old, you almost always want to add ampicillin to their drug regimen. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that comes in and they have like, you know, like a red hot swollen joint, they've been having like severe knee pain, and they have a temperature of 102, what is your next best step in management? Your next best step in management will be to perform an atherosynthesis, okay, because you would want to analyze that joint fluid, right? If you see less than 2000 white cells, you know you're likely dealing with osteoarthritis, right? But if you see like, you know, like 20, 10, 30,000-ish white blood cells, you're probably dealing with maybe like some kind of rheumatoid arthritis. And then if you see like, you know, very high white counts, more than 50,000 white cells, you're probably dealing with more like, you know, like an infectious process, so like septic joint kind of deal. Or you may be dealing with like a crystalline arthropathy, right? So like gout, where you'll find like the negatively the needle-shaped negatively birefringent crystals, or CPPD, where you have the rhomboid-shaped positively birefringent crystals. Now, what if they give you a question about a 55-year-old guy, okay? This guy, over the last 3 months, he has lost a lot of weight, and he's lost like 40 pounds over the last 3 months, and they tell you that this person has smoked 2 packs of cigarettes every day for the past 30 years. And then they tell you that on chest X-ray, you find a nodule in the left upper lobe, and they tell you that the person has a large left-sided pleural effusion. What is your next best step in management? I would hope that you're telling me that you would, for those patients, you want to proceed with getting you want to proceed with getting getting a thoracentesis. Okay, you want to go ahead and get a thoracentesis because if you find malignant cells in that thoracentesis, that's stage four. That's the end of the road, right? You're pretty much, that's stage four lung cancer. There's really not much you can do beyond that. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, they drink like 2 pints of vodka? I don't know if that's, although I'm not really good with these alcoholic measurements, but let's say this person drinks 2 pints of vodka every day, and they come into the hospital, and like maybe their wife or relatives bring them to the hospital. See, this person has been altered for the last few days. This person has been somnolent and, you know, has the classic signs of chronic liver disease. He has like the spider-angiomas, has the gynecomastia, has the asterixis and all that stuff. And they tell you, you know, kind of has a low-grade fever, like 100.9 sort of deal. And then they tell you that on abdominal exam, you notice that he has a mild abdominal tenderness, shifting dullness with like a fluid wave, and they ask for your next best step in diagnosis or in management, right? I would hope you are thinking about performing a paracentesis. The next thing you want to do is a paracentesis. That paracentesis, you're looking for essentially more than 250 white neutrophils, right? That tells you the person has spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. And under those circumstances, you want to go ahead and give them a third generation cephalosporin, like ceftriaxone or cefotaxime. Okay, and then after they recover, you need to put them on fluoroquinolone prophylaxis, you know, relatively for a relatively long period. I won't worry about exact timelines, but for a relatively long period. And remember that SBP is something that can arise in patients with like chronic liver disease. It can arise in patients that have a spontaneous peritoneal dialysis, right? Those are patients that can have those problems. It can arise in a person that has like Budd-Chiari syndrome or like a portal vein thrombosis kind of deal. Okay, so those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then what if they give you a question about a 55 year old guy and they tell you that, you know, he had an MI like 3 days ago, or he has like a history of AFib, and he tells you that over the last 2 hours he has been complaining of severe sudden onset leg pain, right? Like left leg pain. And they tell you that his legs appear, you know, pale to the touch, and they're like cold and all that stuff. Right off the bat, I would hope you're telling me that this person has an acute limb ischemia. Your next best step in management is to proceed with giving that person heparin, right? An IV infusion of heparin, okay? You would not want to make the costly mistake of maybe like trying to do like, an ankle brachial index or whatever. No. Your next step in management is to provide, to give a heparin infusion. And then after that, the second thing you will do is to obtain vascular surgery consultation, right? So that they can go and explore the leg and maybe bypass the leg or whatever, because time is limb, right? Within like 6 hours, that person's limb is essentially gone. And they gave you a similar patient population, again, recent MI or history of AFib. And then they tell you that this patient is complaining of a severe abdominal pain. And they tell you that his abdomen is exquisitely tender to palpation. I would hope, again, what you're thinking about under those circumstances are like acute mesenteric ischemia. Your next step in management is actually to perform angiography, right? So that you can find the vessel that they've occluded with an embolic phenomenon. That's usually the superior mesenteric artery, right? So you do angiography because that's diagnostic and that's also therapeutic. Now, what if you get a question about a 65-year-old guy, and this guy comes in to, you know, his PCP's office and says that for the past 6 months, he has not been able to like go to work regularly because he has been having like severe bilateral leg pain. And they tell you that he has smoked 3 packs of cigarettes every day for the past 40 years, right? I would hope if you saw something like that, you'd be thinking about peripheral arterial disease. Your next best step in management in that situation will be to obtain an ankle brachial index. Okay, to obtain an ankle brachial index, if it's less than 0.9, you have your answer. The person has PAD. Alternatively, if they tell you that the person's ABI that was measured is like 1.5, it's like super high, but they have all these symptoms, you're like, this person probably is like a diabetic and they have something called like Munkerberg calcific sclerosis. So under those circumstances, your next step will be to obtain a toe brachial index, okay, a TBI, a toe brachial index, to establish the diagnosis. And then your next step in management for those people is, you know, supervised exercise program, like a supervised walking program. You would also want to consider doing things like, you'd want to consider doing things like, what is it called? You know, if the supervised walking program is not cutting it, you can do things like recommend celostazole. Remember, celostazole is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor that vasodilates vessels, right? So it can help under those circumstances. If that's not cutting it, then you need to do some kind of bypass. But before you do that bypass, you need to do some kind of arteriography. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about 30-year-old guy, right? And they tell you that this guy, you know, has a history of, you know, hearing voices. And they tell you that this person, whenever he has had multiple hospitalizations in the past, and whenever he's hospitalized and started on his antipsychotics, he gets better. But that he, you know, upon discharge, he stops taking his meds and his symptoms come right back. And he asks for your next step in management. Your next step in management under those circumstances will be to give that person something called haloperidol decanoate. Remember, that's the depot form of haloperidol, right? It essentially lasts for a month. You just give that intramuscular injection and that tidies the patient over for a month. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that was recently started on an antipsychotic and they tell you that this person, their face is kind of like, their faces are kind of faced in one direction. It's hard for them to move like one of the extremities. And they ask for your next best step in management, right? For those people, you want to go ahead and give them like diphenhydramine, or you can give them benztropine. Remember, diphenhydramine is an antihistamine that has very powerful anticholinergic activity. So you give those people a diphenhydramine to treat their acute dystonia. What if they give you a similar patient population and they tell you that the patient feels like his body wants to jump out of his skin? He paces all around the exam room, doesn't want to stay in one place. Under those circumstances, right, you should be thinking about akathisia, right? And for akathisia, your next step in management will be to give a beta blocker. Beta blockers are first line for the management of akathisia. And then second line for the management of akathisia is a benzodiazepine. And then what if they give you again a similar scenario, you know, patient with a history of schizophrenia, and this patient, they tell you that this patient, you know, is having like, you know, like resting tremors, is having like trouble like moving, right? So he has like bradykinesia. Under those circumstances, I hope you're thinking about Parkinson's, like Parkinsonism. And under those circumstances, your next step in management will be to first line administer a muscarinic antagonist like benztropine, okay, or like trihexyphenidyl. Your second line agents will be to consider giving a dopamine receptor agonist like bromocriptine or cabergoline or like apomorphine or like a ropinirole, for example. And then if they give you a question about a patient, you know, they've been on an antipsychotic for a while, and then they tell you that, oh, this patient is now having like, you know, like repetitive movements of the tongue or like their head or whatever, then I would hope that under those circumstances, you're thinking about tardive dyskinesia. Your next step in management is to stop the drug, okay? Your next step in management is to go ahead and stop the drug. And then after you stop the drug, you then switch them to an atypical antipsychotic, like quetiapine or something along those lines. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that has a history of let's see. So this patient, they tell you it's like a 35-year-old female. She has a BMI of 40, and they tell you that whenever she comes into the PCP's office, says she's been having like morning headaches, like for the last like for the last like 3 weeks. And some, when she wakes up in the morning, she kind of has like a lot of blurry vision. And they ask for your next best step in management. I would really hope that your next step in management for those people will be to, you know, get like some get like a lumbar puncture, because those patients have an idiopathic intracranial hypertension, which is also known as a pseudotumor cerebri. So under those circumstances, you'd want to go ahead and give those patients like acetazolamide, or you can go ahead and consider serial therapeutic lumbar punctures to fix their problems. Another potential next step in management for those people may be to stop the doxycycline that they are taking, or to stop the acne medication like the vitamin A analog that they are taking, because those things all exacerbate pseudotumor cerebri. And then what if they give you a question about a 35-year-old guy, right? This guy, you know, comes in, says he's been having, you know, just terrible headaches for the last like 3 months, right? He has them almost every day. It has like a pulsatile sensation. He has to rest in a dark room and all that crap to feel better, and it's preventing him from, you know, getting to work all the time. Under those circumstances, your next step in management will be to put that patient on a chronic migraine medication, right? And your options on MDMEs are things like propranolol, right? Again, if a person has like a history of asthma, propranolol maybe not the best idea in the world, because remember, right, that beta 2 vaso bronchoconstrictive effect from a beta blocker, a non-selective beta blocker like propranolol. Another thing you'll want to do under those circumstances is to, you could also consider topiramate. Okay, remember, topiramate is associated with nephrolithiasis. And then the third thing you could also consider under those circumstances are the tricyclic antidepressants. Okay, remember, the classic telltale sign on MBME exams of tricyclic antidepressant toxicity is a white QRS on an EKG. But if a person is acutely having migraine symptoms, your next step in management will be to administer sumatriptan. Okay, you'd want to go ahead and administer sumatriptan. Or you can give them like an ergotamine derivative, okay, that can abort their headaches relatively quickly. If they give you like a similar question, you know, patient having like, you know, unilateral headache, rhinorrhea, like conjunctival injection, I hope you're thinking about cluster headaches, and they ask for your next step in management, you want to go ahead and give them, you know, like 100% oxygen. That will usually abort the headache relatively quickly. And then, what if they give you a question about, okay, so let's assume you get a question about, you know, like a 30-year-old guy, you know, history of like treatment resistance and schizophrenia, and they tell you that, you know, 2 weeks ago he was started on a new medication, but they tell you that over the last 24 hours he has been having you know, like pretty high fevers, so his temperature is like 103, and he's and you know, they give you like CBC results, and you notice that his total white blood cell count is like 2000, and like 20% of that and is neutrophils, right? And then they ask for your next step in management. The next step in management will like ideally be to stop the drug, right? To stop the clozapin that they've been placed on because they have a granulocytosis. But after that, the next thing you want to do is to place them on an anti-pseudomonal agent, okay? On an anti-pseudomonal agent, because this patient essentially has neutropenic fever, okay? This patient essentially has neutropenic fever. So you place them on an anti-pseudomonal agent. You'd want to do something like, you know, like meropenem, right? Or you'd want to do something like imipenem, or you want to essentially do something that covers pseudomonas, okay? Something that covers pseudomonas. Remember, they can also give you a similar question in a patient that, you know, has been on chemotherapy, and then they have like a neutropenic fever from that. Or they can give you a fairly similar question in a patient that, you know, is on, has a history of like Graves' disease or whatever, and is on an anti-thyroid medication like PTU or methimazole. Now, what if they give you a question about you know, like a patient that has been, you know, like a long-term smoker, and they come into the hospital, and they tell you that over the last 7 days they've been having increased sputum production, shortness of breath, and all that, whatever, right? And then they ask for this person is a long-term smoker, and they ask for your next best step in management. Your next best step in management under those circumstances is to strongly consider placing them on IV corticosteroids, because that patient is going through a COPD exacerbation, right? So you want to go ahead and, you know, place them on IV corticosteroids. If they've already done that in the Q-stem, you could consider placing them on like bronchodilators, right? So you want to place them on a muscarinic receptor, a muscarinic receptor antagonist, right? Like ipratropium or tiotropium, right? And then if those things have already been done in the question, you can consider placing them on azithromycin, okay? Because it has like some anti-inflammatory properties that help in the setting of a COPD exacerbation. And then what if you get a question about, you know, like like a 60-year-old guy. They tell you that this guy has, you know, a pretty long history of aortic regurgitation. And then he tells you that over the past like 3 days, he's been having like profound shortness of breath. He's had to sleep on multiple pillows to be able to like catch his breath and all that stuff. He has like dyspnea on exertion. And they tell you that he has like an S3 heart sound kind of deal. And then they ask for your next best step in management. I would really hope that the answer you're going after with that is to consider giving that patient like IV furosemide, okay? IV furosemide to treat their CHF exacerbation, right? And really for CHF exacerbation, you give like an IV diuretic, like again, an IV loop diuretic. I mean, if it was a patient in the question that has like a sulfur allergy, then you can consider doing something like ethacrynic acid that would help under those circumstances. Although remember, ethacrynic acid is like super nephro and ototoxic, so you want to maybe, you know, think twice before pulling a stunt like that, right? And then other things you can also do, you can place those patients on, you know, you can give them nitrates. Nitrates are actually very good at relieving the dyspnea from pulmonary edema. And I guess since I'm sort of talking about dyspnea from CHF, if they give you a question about a patient that has like cancer that is terminal, and the patient has dyspnea and they ask for your next best step in management, you would actually want to go ahead and place them on morphine. Morphine is the drug of choice for the treatment of dyspnea in a patient that has a cancer, that has like terminal cancer or like some kind of terminal disease and they are dyspneic. Okay, again, I promise you, these are all things, next best steps in management that you'd want to know for sure for your exam. Now, what if they give you a question about, you know, like an 75-year-old guy, you know, this guy has smoked a ton for the past, like, I don't know, like, let's say 4 packs a day for 50 years, right? That'd be a little over the top, though. I've never seen a person smoke that much, but anyhow. So, that's like a 200-pack-year smoking history. And then this guy, he comes to his PCP and says that over the last, like, you know, like 6 weeks, he's been having, like, a lot of pain in his fingers and his legs, right? He tells you that he's been having, like, a ton of joint pain, kind of started, like, 6 weeks ago. And he has tried taking like NSAIDs and they have not helped at all, right? And then they tell you that, oh, on physical exam, you notice a lot of finger clubbing and they ask for the next best step in management. Your next best step in management for this patient is to go ahead and obtain some kind of chest imaging. Usually on MBMs, you'll be able to get like a chest X-ray or chest CT, right? Because this person has something called a hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy, right? So those people have, they essentially have a lung cancer, right? So for those people, remember the hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy, it's a paraneoplastic phenomenon. So if you observe it in this patient, you know, the smart thing to do would be to go ahead and obtain some kind of chest imaging to look for the lung cancer that they have. Now, let's assume you get a question about a patient, and let's say it's like a 50-something-year-old female. She tells you that she's been having a lot of trouble at work because she falls asleep a lot. And she says that she's having a lot of trouble sleeping at home because she feels like there's this crawling sensation in her leg while she's asleep, right? And then they ask you for your next best step in management. Your next best step in management for this patient will be to go ahead and prescribe a dopamine agonist like a pramipexol or ropinirole, right? Or alternatively on MBMEs, because this is something they've sort of started like, you know, throwing in on exams, is giving a drug like primidone. Primidone is a barbiturate, right? This patient essentially has, This patient essentially has a restless leg syndrome, right? So under those circumstances, you place them on a dopamine agonist like pramipexol or ropinirole, or you can place them on a barbiturate like primidone, okay? You can see why primidone will be a high-value answer for the MBMEs because it's something that most people don't know, and it does not sound like most of the barbiturates that people know. So that's what you do under those circumstances. And restless leg syndrome has an association with iron deficiency anemia. So that's something, again, you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, what if they give you a question, you know, about like a 30-year-old guy? They tell you that, you know, over the last like 6 months, this guy has been having, you know, he's worrying about paying the bills, worrying about doing well in his grad classes, worrying about providing this for his family, worrying about crushing the USMLE step one and step two CK and step three exams all in one day. You know, he's worried about everything in life, right? So what's your diagnosis for this person? I hope you're telling me a generalized anxiety disorder, right? And they ask for your next best step in management. Your next best step in management will actually be to consider obtaining, consider prescribing an SSRI, right? Remember, SSRIs are first line for the treatment of generalized anxiety disorder. If you don't see an SSRI as an answer choice, then you want to, you know, maybe proceed with a drug like a Bospiro. Remember, Bospiro is a partial serotonin receptor agonist. It's like a 5-HT2A receptor agonist that can be used to treat generalized anxiety disorder. Now, what if they give you a question about, a 25-year-old female, right? You know, this person, you know, has a history of depression, and they tell you that this patient was placed on, venlafaxine or sertraline like 4 weeks ago. And then this patient comes in and says that they want to stop the drug, that, you know, they've been having, let's say it's a man, and he's been having trouble like getting it up with his wife and stuff like that. If you see that kind of situation, what is your next best step in management? I would hope on an MBME you choose the answer choice that involves a switching to bupropion. Remember, bupropion is an NDRI. It's a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor. And it's one of those psych drugs, right, that those antidepressants that does not have a sexual side effects. And remember, it's also good at helping with like smoking cessation. It's also good with helping with things like, weight loss, right? But remember, you don't want to give it to a person, you know, that has like problems that may predispose them to seizures. So like anorexia nervosa or bulimia, right? You want to avoid it. Or if a person has like any history of seizures or like hyponatremia or something, you don't want to give them those things, right? So if a person has like a history of SIDH, that'll be a very unique way to, you know, not give those people a bupropion on an MBMA exam. And then what if you get a question about, 50-year-old female, she comes in, they tell you that, you know, over the last, you know, 2 months, she is, you know, felt guilty about everything in life. She no longer enjoys things that she used to enjoy. She sleeps 14 hours a day. She endorses like a low mood. And they tell you that, you know, she feels like she has low energy all the time. And then they give you some vitals, and you notice that one of the things they tell you is, oh, the person's like heart rate is like, you know, like 49 beats per minute. What's your next best step in management? I would really hope that your next step in management is to obtain a TSH, right? Because remember, TSH can cause like pseudo-depression, especially if you see that bradycardia. Bradycardia is a very specific finding on MBME exams for hypothyroidism. So your next step in management for that patient will actually be to go ahead and obtain a TSH. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a 45-year-old male? He tells you that, you know, for the past 2 weeks he's been having palpitations and he's lost like 10 pounds. And they tell you on physical exam his blood pressure is like 180 over 90. And his heart rate is like 190 beats per minute and irregular. And then they tell you that all of a sudden the patient, you know, kind of becomes like somnolent. Almost becomes comatose, becomes altered, and they ask for your next best step in management. I would hope you are choosing to give that patient a propranolol, right? This patient is essentially in thyroid storm. Remember, the most common arrhythmia in patients with hyperthyroidism is AFib, right? So your next step in management will be to administer propranolol. That is always the first drug you administer in a patient that has a thyroid storm. And then after that, you give PTU. PTU is the second drug you give. And then after that, you can knock yourself out with whatever you want to give. You can give steroids. You can give a supersaturated solution of potassium iodide. Sometimes on MBMEs, they call that Lugol's solution, right? Those are the things you'd want to do under those circumstances. And then, what if they give you a question about like a 70-year-old guy? They tell you that over the last like 1 year, he's been like, you know, he's forgets to turn off the stove, forgets to, he does not remember friends he's had for years. he loses his will on coming back to the, you know, from the grocery store, and then they tell you he cannot repeat serial sevens and all that crap. And then they ask for the next best step in diagnosis. You'll actually want to go ahead and obtain an MRI of the brain. This person likely has Alzheimer's, right? So you want to go ahead and obtain a brain MRI. Usually, if a person, if you suspect Alzheimer's, that buys that patient one brain MRI, right? You go ahead and get a brain MRI. And then after that, your next step in management will be to give like a drug like donepezil or galantamine or rivastigmine, right? Remember, those are acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, right? They are indicated for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. Now remember, in Alzheimer's, right, the basal nucleus of Meynert is destroyed, so those people have like no acetylcholine. Alternatively, they can have like dysfunction of choline acetyltransferase, right? Remember, that's the rate-limiting enzyme in acetylcholine synthesis. Now, what if they give you a question about a 35-year-old guy, this guy, let's say, drinks 2 pints of vodka every day, and then he comes into, like, the emergency room. You know, he said over the past, like, 2 days, he's been having, like, severe, like, pain in his, like, his mid-abdomen, kind of going to his back. And then they ask for the next best step in management, right? Your next best step in management will be to administer IV fluids, right? You administer those IV fluids because this person has pancreatitis, right? Likely has, you know, pancreatitis from like alcoholism. So your next best step in management will be, you know, go ahead and administer IV fluids and make the patient like NPO, right? So IV fluids, NPO, pain control, and that's pretty much all you do. They will try to trick you on the exam to get you to, you know, pick like giving antibiotics. Do not do that. I mean, it's very rare. Antibiotics are very rarely the correct answer for the treatment of acute pancreatitis. And remember, in acute pancreatitis, right, those people's lipases will be the lipase is more specific for the diagnosis of pancreatitis than amylase. And then, what if they give you a question about, like, a 40-year-old female, you know, she has, like, a 2-year history of, like, Graves' disease that is well-controlled with methimazole. And then, they tell you that she comes into the emergency room because she's been having like palpitations for the last like 2 hours, and then they give you some vitals. You know, the person's heart rate is like 220 beats per minute, and then they tell you that her pulse is irregular, and then they tell you that the patient becomes altered or becomes like comatose or loses consciousness or whatever. Or you know what, let me not go that far. Let me just say they tell you that the patient appears confused and their blood pressure suddenly drops to like 70/40, and your friends at the MBME ask for the next best step in management. Under those circumstances, the next thing you would want to do, believe it or not, is to actually perform a synchronized cardioversion. I know a person listening to this may be saying, what? I promise that's the right thing to do. Whenever a person has an arrhythmia and they are hemodynamically unstable, your next best step in management is always to perform a synchronized cardioversion. And remember, there are many other terms for synchronized cardioversion, like direct current cardioversion, DC cardioversion, direct current countershock. Those all mean the same thing, okay? So if a person has AFib and they're hemodynamically unstable, resist the temptation to pick giving a beta blocker or non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker or amiodarone or adenosine. No, no, no. Your next step in management for those people is to perform a synchronized cardioversion. You want to go ahead and perform a synchronized cardioversion. And then, but I guess if you're thinking about other, like, you know, like AFib decision trees, you know, if a person has a history of AFib and, you know, you just want to manage them, right? Yeah, the right thing to do will be to, you know, like AFib and, you know, they are like relatively stable. You can go ahead and you can try like your vagal maneuvers, massage the carotids, dunk their heads in cold water. You can tell them to blow into a straw kind of deal. You can try all those things. But if, for example, you don't see that as an answer choice, you know, you'd want to maybe consider putting them on like a beta blocker, right? Or a dihydropyridine, a calcium channel blocker like a verapamil or diltiazem. And just as a high yield factor, remember that verapamil is associated with a hyperprolactinemia. So that's just one weird thing you want to commit to memory. And remember, in AFib, right, you can pursue like a rate control strategy or rhythm control strategy. Your rate control strategy is, again, basically beta blocker, or non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil, diltiazem, or digoxin. Remember, digoxin is a muscarinic receptor agonist in addition to blocking the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So under those circumstances, you can actually use digoxin for AFib. And then rhythm control is amiodarone essentially, right? Now, what if you get a question about, a 25-year-old guy, you know, he comes in, palpitations, they tell you that his heart rate is 250 beats per minute, he has like the irregular crap, that's AFib, and then they also tell you that he has a history of Wolff Parkinson White, and they ask for your next best step in management. Under those circumstances, you want to go ahead and prescribe a procainamide. Okay, remember, if a patient has WPW syndrome and they have AFib, you always want to go ahead and treat those people with procainamide. You absolutely positively do not want to use an AV nodal blocking agent. So things like beta blockers are a big no-no. Non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like verapamil, diltiazem are a big no-no. Digoxin, remember, digoxin slows down conduction through the AV node, right? Because it's also has muscarinic receptor agonist activity. That's a big no-no. Adenosine, which slows conduction down the AV node, is a big no-no. Because if you do any of those things, you will essentially say like, oh, open pathway to go straight through that accessory tract from the atria to the ventricles, and you convert that patient's AFib to VFib, and then you have a very big problem on your hands under those circumstances. So you absolutely positively do not want to do that on an NBME exam. Now, let's assume they give you a question about a 40-year-old female. Okay, they tell you that, okay, let's make this because I have a variation I want to introduce. This is a 30-year-old female, comes to the you know, PCP's office, says that she's been having like severe like abdominal pain for the past like 3 months. And they tell you that on palpation of the abdomen, you know, you palpate the uterus, it kind of feels soft and globular and boggy, right? And then they ask for your next step in management. Your next step in management is actually to prescribe the Mirena IUD. This person has adenomyosis. But if they give you the qualifier in the Q-stem, and it will likely be in like a person that's a little older, like in like her early 40s, and they give you the qualifier that the patient doesn't want to have kids anymore, then, and like they're tired of the pain, blah, 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 then under those circumstances, you'd want to consider proceeding with a hysterectomy, okay? That's the definitive treatment for adenomyosis. And if they're asking you for the diagnostic test for adenomyosis, you actually want to go ahead and perform an MRI of the abdomen, okay, like a uterine MRI essentially. If you don't see that as an answer choice, go ahead and choose like a laparoscopy. That's the only way you can definitively diagnose adenomyosis. In fact, if they word the question this way and say, which of the following is the gold standard test, or if is the definitive test, or it's like the test that can confirm the diagnosis, they're essentially saying what's gold standard. That's actually diagnostic laparoscopy. That's how you ultimately are able to diagnose adenomyosis. And then, what if they give you a question about, you know, like a 45-year-old female, she has a BMI of 40, comes into the hospital, she says over the last 2 days, she's been having like severe pain in her, you know, like a upper right abdomen, and they give you vitals, her temperature is like 101, and you know, she has like a Y count of like 12,000, and then they ask for your next best step in management, right? I would hope you're telling me get a right upper quadrant ultrasound. But let's assume that the right upper quadrant ultrasound is negative or it's equivocal, right? And you still strongly suspect, obviously, right, this patient having acute cholecystitis. Your next step in management under those circumstances will be to proceed with a HIDA scan, right? And then after the HIDA scan confirms what you want, they may say, at 60 minutes or whatever, there is non-visualization of the non-visualization. I mean, if you want to be like super accurate, it's more like, oh, like after 4 hours, there's no visualization of the gallbladder. If you're like wondering why it's four, don't worry, wonder about why it's 4 hours. I'm just saying that to be accurate. If you're wondering, ask any radiologist friend you have. But basically, they say, oh, non-visualization of the gallbladder at 4 hours after a HIDA scan. That tells you the patient has acute cholecystitis. Your next step in management will be to perform a cholecystectomy. But what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, been in the hospital for like, you know, like 2 weeks, severely ill, complain of right upper quadrant pain, has like a fever, has a leukocytosis, and let's say you perform next step in management, you're like, oops, acute cholecystitis, you get a right upper quadrant ultrasound. And then let's say that on right upper quadrant ultrasound, you see like dilation of the wall of the gallbladder, you see pericholecystic fluid, but then they add in the qualifier that there is no, that you do not see dilation of the cystic duct, or you do not visualize an obstructing stone. And then they ask for your next step in management. Your next step in management for those patients is actually something called a percutaneous cholecystostomy. Okay, you actually want to go ahead and perform a percutaneous cholecystostomy. They will try to trick you by giving you an answer choice that involves performing an acute cholecystectomy. That's a terrible idea. You don't want to do that, right? You want to go ahead and perform a percutaneous cholecystostomy, because essentially that patient has acalculus cholecystitis, right? So under those circumstances, you want to perform a percutaneous cholecystostomy. Performing an acute cholecystectomy has like high morbidity and mortality in acalculus cholecystitis. Now, let's assume you get a question about a patient that, let's see, how do I word this question? So let's say they, you know, give you a question about a 17-year-old kid, okay? This kid wakes up with like morning headaches, they have headaches all the time. And then they tell you that the kid's BMI is like 40. And then they tell you on physical exam his respiratory rate is like 8. And then they give you like ABGs, you notice that his PCO2 is like 60, right? And they ask for your next best step in management. I would really hope under those circumstances that you're considering a polysomnogram, right? Like a sleep study. This kid essentially has like OSA, or maybe like if you're being like super particular, this patient has obesity hypoventilation syndrome. If a person has OSA, OHS, if a patient has narcolepsy, right? So falling asleep, falling down when he laughs, all that crap. Right, those things, your next step in management is always to perform a polysomnogram, right, a sleep study, to make the formal diagnosis of whatever is going on. Now, what if they give you a question about a 6-month-old? They tell you that this patient, the parents noticed that this patient has been having, like over the last 2 weeks, the patient has been having like just seizures all the time, like generalized, like whole body seizures. And they tell you that on physical exam, this kid has like hypopigmented macules on the skin. And then they ask for your next best step in management, right? Your next best step in management for that kid will be to administer ACTH, right? So this kid has infantile spasms, right? Like West syndrome. Remember, it's like the seizure disorder that you find in kids with tuberous sclerosis. So the thing you do under those circumstances is to give ACTH. If you get an EEG in those kids, you'll find the classically described hips arrhythmia. Okay, you'll find the classically described hips arrhythmia. Okay, and again, you treat it with ACTH. If they really want to mess with your head on an exam, they can give you something like a vigabatrin. Now, what if they give you a question about like a 23-year-old guy? They tell you that, you know, he has a BMI of like 18, and they tell you that over the last 3 days, he's been having like severe bloody diarrhea. And then they tell you that on exam, he has like severe abdominal distension, rebound garden. And then they ask for your next best step in management. I would really hope that you are choosing exploratory laparotomy, right? This patient has a toxic megacolon from like ulcerative colitis, right? So under those circumstances, once you suspect toxic megacolon, you always want to proceed to performing an exploratory laparotomy. So an exploratory laparotomy is typically on MBM is the next best step in management in people that have like toxic megacolon from like C. diff, toxic megacolon from like ulcerative colitis, toxic megacolon from like Trypanosoma cruzii. Or if a person has like penetrating trauma to the abdomen, right? So if a patient, for example, has a stab wound to the abdomen or a gunshot wound to the abdomen, you want to go ahead with exploratory laparotomy. Another classic one is if you perform an X-ray and you see free air under the diaphragm, right? You also want to again proceed with a X-lap. The thing is, your friends on the MBME, instead of saying exploratory laparotomy, they may call it exploratory ciliotomy. It's one and the same thing. Now, what if you get a question about like a nurse, and they tell you that she gets stuck by a needle from like, you know, some patient, and they give you like, you know, serologies for the patient, the herpes surface antigen is positive, so you're like, oh crap, this patient has hep B. And then they tell you that this nurse has, you know, like had the hep B vaccine like 2 years ago and was confirmed to be immune, and they ask for your next best step in management. Your next best step in management under those circumstances is no further action, right? No further action. Because remember that if a person is immune to hep B, then you don't need to do any kind of post-exposure prophylaxis. But if they're non-immune, your next step in management will be to give the hep B vaccine, right? And then to give the hep B immune globulin, okay? Those are actually very high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then, what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, has a history of HIV, and they tell you that this patient's CD4 count is like, you know, like 600, so, you know, doing pretty well. He's on highly active antiretroviral therapy. They make this like a super nondescript question, and then they ask for your next best step in management. If it's in the fall, you want to go ahead and give them the influenza vaccine. That'll be your next best step in management. If it's like not in the fall and you don't see like an influenza vaccine as your answer choice, the next best step in management will actually be to give them the pneumococcal vaccine, right? Remember, the pneumococcal vaccine, you tend to give it to people that have like, especially people that are under 50, you give it to people under like, I guess, let me be a little more specific. People under 65, you can give them the pneumococcal vaccine if they have like chronic conditions, right? So like chronic kidney disease or cirrhosis, or they're like smokers, or they're diabetics, or they have like CSF leaks kind of deal. Those people do deserve they do deserve the pneumococcal vaccine, okay? And again, obviously, if you're over 65, you do need the pneumococcal vaccine. That's just kind of like a high yield thing to know. Now, what if they give you a question about, a 22-year-old, like, you know, G1P1 female, and let's say G2P1 female, and she's at like, you know, like 18 weeks gestation, and let's say like at a prior doctor's visit or obstetrician's visit, they noticed that the maternal serum alpha fetal protein was elevated, and they did like an ultrasound and it was negative. And then they say that, oh, a decision is made to pursue an amniocentesis. And then you perform the amniocentesis and you obtain samples, and then they ask for the next best step in management. I would really hope under those circumstances that you're considering giving Rogam. Okay, remember, whenever you have anything that can mix mom and baby's blood, you always want to get Rogam. Okay, you always want to get Rogam. You always want to get Rogam, right? Because you want to make sure that mom is not sensitized. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about like a 37-year-old female, you know? They tell you that she's been having like heavy menstrual bleeding over the last like 3 months, and they tell you that her BMI is 35, and she has her menses every like 70 days, something weird. And then they ask for the next best step in management. Ideally, you want to go ahead and place that patient on OCPs, like a combined OCP. But let's assume a combined OCP is not an answer choice. One nifty answer choice your friends at the MB may slot on an exam will be to actually do an endometrial biopsy or like endometrial sampling, because that patient actually has a pretty high risk. I mean, obviously, this patient has PCOS. So that patient has a pretty high risk of like endometrial hyperplasia or endometrial cancer. So under those circumstances, you strongly want to consider getting endometrial sampling in those circumstances. So you may say, oh, Divine, but she's less than 50. Here's the thing. If a patient is less than 50 and they have like a very high risk of endometrial cancer, so like a patient that has like a history of PCOS, or a patient that has a long-term history of taking tamoxifen, and they present with like bleeding, that's kind of like out of the ordinary for them, you want to go ahead and get an endometrial biopsy, okay? And then let's assume you get a question about, you know, like a 25-year-old guy. he just came back from like spring break, and you know, maybe he had sex with like, you know, like 12 women, and he used condoms inconsistently. And then they tell you that, oh, on his penis you find like a painless, well circumscribed lesion with hip thigh borders, and they ask for your next best step in management. The next best step in management, I hope, will be to obtain like the RPR or the VDRL test, right? That this person has syphilis essentially. After that, right, your next step after that will be to get like the, you know, the treponemal test. Remember, RPR, VDRL, those are non-treponemal tests. They are for screening. The next thing you want to do to confirm the diagnosis will be to get those treponemal tests. They have like weird names like FTA, ABS, and MHETP, okay? So that's what you do under those circumstances. And then, remember syphilis, right? Remember secondary syphilis, rash on the palms and soles. And syphilis, obviously, if you want to treat, you give IV penicillin, right? You give penicillin G. You don't give penicillin V. Penicillin V, bad idea. That's oral penicillin. Penicillin G, IV penicillin, good idea. Okay? Good idea. Now, what if they give you a question about... they give you a question about, you know, like a 35-year-old guy. And this guy is going for like, you know, like eye surgery or whatever. And then they say like 20 minutes after induction, this patient... the anesthesiologist notices that he has like stiffness in all his extremities, his temperature is 105, and they ask for your next best step in management. The next best step in management, I hope you're saying, is to go ahead and obtain, to go ahead and administer dantrolene. The thing is, your friends at the MBM, instead of saying administering dantrolene, they may say administer a calcium channel blocker. That will also be the correct answer. Remember, dantrolene is in fact a calcium channel blocker, right? Because this patient clearly has a malignant hyperthermia. And in malignant hyperthermia, it's autosomal dominant inheritance. Those people have like mutations in the dihydropyridine and the ryanodine receptor. The ryanodine receptor mutation is more common. So those people have like too much release of calcium from their sarcoplasmic reticulum. So they have like a crap ton of muscle contraction. So the thing you would do is to essentially give like a ryanodine receptor antagonist like dantrolene, and that will fix the symptoms, right? Because that will prevent the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Now, what if you get a question about a 20-year-old guy, you know, he's an IV drug user, and they tell you that, you know, he admits to... hold on, let me make up this question. Sorry, I'm just literally like sitting on a couch and talking through these things. I don't know, the question has just disappeared from my mind, so I guess we will have to move on from that. I will try to keep this to like an hour, or maybe like just a tinge, a smidge above an hour. Again, I'll make many next best step in management podcasts. It's just literally like, if I literally had to sit down and conjure all like everything I have in my mind on next best steps in management, I'll probably make like a 40-hour podcast from that. That's obviously not practical, right? And I'm a resident, so I clearly have to, you know, do like, you know, resident things, like, you know, like sleep, for example. I'll have to make other podcasts in the future on this. In fact, since we're kind of like, you know, coming up on an hour, let me go ahead and pause here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I actually tutor to the internal medicine boards, so like the ABIM exam. I tutor to the internal medicine in training exam. If you're a college student and you need tutoring in like physics, gen chem, ochem, biochem, physiology, histology, I offer tutoring for all those things. And then, again, there's this thing I've been doing fairly recently that a lot of, it's not something I've been doing recently. I've done it for a while, but I'm beginning to get like more people sign up with me for this, is longitudinal tutoring. So I've done this especially with like med students like studying out med school. The thing I do is I tutor them for all their class exams, right? And again, as I'm tutoring them for all their class exams, I'm infusing step one knowledge along the way, so that essentially when they hit their dedicated periods, they're like super ready for their tests. And I've had like very strong, solid results with these. Same thing with like people starting out third year, like again, longitudinal tutoring. I kind of like, again, tutor them for all their shelf exams, and then I tutor them with their dedicated periods. Again, I've had people do very well with this. I typically end up meeting these people for like 2 to 3 hours every week. But essentially, over the course of that year, I prepare you very strongly one-on-one for the USMLE exam that's going to essentially be coming up at the end of your bid, either third year or second year if you're a preclinical student. I've started actually doing this with some internal medicine residents. As they're going through their rotations, I tutor them based on like the stuff that's commonly tested. So if you need any of those things, or you know anyone that needs any of those things, feel free to send them my way. You can either go through the website, or you can send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. So I hope you gain a lot from this podcast. Again, I know it was a long one, but it's a very high yield one. So I wish you all the best. Have a great rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you next time.